Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's eruption time in Alaska these days. 110 miles southwest of Anchorage, Mount Redoubt has come alive. Here's a taste over scenes of the volcano from Anchorage TV KTUU.
Well, Steve, the eruption scattered ash across a wide swath of the Susitna Valley, but on the mountain flanks of Redoubt, the evidence of the eruptions is more dramatic.
And yes, it's been dramatic. Ash plumes miles high, air traffic grounded, evacuation alert for big oil storage threatened by Redoubt's mud flows. Far south in Chile, the volcano Chaiten roared back to life last month, and in the South Pacific, volcanic eruption from undersea. This hour, On Point will go to the flanks of Mount Redoubt and bring in the volcanologists to look at what's going on with volcanoes. You can join the conversation. Have you been following the reports from Redoubt, from North and South and South Pacific? What's your experience of volcanoes? What's your question on volcanoes? We will hear in this hour from top experts on America's own 165 volcanoes and volcanoes around the world. We start with Mount Redoubt. Joining me from the operations room of the Alaska Volcano Observatory in Anchorage is Peter Cervelli, a volcanologist and geophysicist on the job there. Peter Cervelli, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And from Girdwood, Alaska, his colleague, Cyrus Reed. Cyrus Reed is an engineer and geophysicist with the Volcano Observatory, and this week has been right up close to the active Mount Redoubt. Cyrus, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
When were you there? Where were you exactly? How close to the, well, describe it for us, Cyrus. Where were you? It's tough territory out there by Mount Redoubt.
Well, on Monday, the day after the initial eruption, me and two others flew out, and it was kind of a foggy day with some light snow, but we were able to fly over the oil terminal and up the Drift River and got a look at the lower flanks of the volcano, and then also fix some equipment that had been damaged during the eruption.
Now, this is an oil terminal down the valley there, I guess, owned by Chevron. Some worry about whether there would be another big eruption sending mud flows down into that. We'll look at that. But what about that scene on the, I don't know how you describe it, is the outer flanks of Redoubt? What could you see? The peak has been mainly cloud-covered, I guess, Cyrus.
Yeah, that's correct. It's been pretty cloudy there, but down low we saw, you know, evidence of large mud flows and different kinds of airfall. There was a lot of pumice on the ground, and there was a bunch of ash, and that was about all we saw. You know, a lot of snow, ashy slopes.
Peter Cervelli, back in Anchorage, I mean, you've described Redoubt's terrain as, you know, remote, glacial, full of grizzlies. You've been following this on the scientific equipment, monitoring what's going on. When did you first get the idea that an eruption might be coming? How early could you predict that? And then when did it actually come? And how big an eruption was this, Peter?
Sure. Well, we've been following Redoubt unrest, as we call it, mm-hmm. Since... Well, by some accounts, since the summer, although it really became a major issue for us back in November, things slowly escalated, and by mid-January of 2009, we were pretty confident that an eruption was imminent. In fact, we used that language, but it turned out that it wasn't exactly imminent, because it took another month and a half or so before it actually did erupt. But we've been seeing signs, geophysical signs, that this volcano has been in a heightened state of unrest for months. And I have to say that we were, to a certain extent, relieved when it finally did erupt over the weekend, because we had been getting everybody quite wound up about the prospect of an eruption, and we were worried that this might have been a so-called failed eruption when magma actually fails to reach the surface.
And what kind of eruption was this? Was this the kind that, you know, we've seen that blows over miles and miles of trees and buries half the land for miles around, or just ash plume straight up, or how would you describe it, Peter?
Well, nobody has actually seen the summit of the mountain yet since the major explosions because of bad weather.
But for example, when you look back to Mount St. Helens, you didn't have to see the top to know that it had taken out a huge chunk of countryside.
That's correct. And these explosions were not even remotely close in size to the explosions that occurred at Mount St. Helens on May 18th, 1980. These were probably 100 times smaller. They're still pretty good size explosions. They put ash up to about 50,000 feet above
in the atmosphere.
But we're talking about a different category of eruption entirely.
Cyrus, what was it like when you were out there near Readout? I mean, did you see evidence of what was coming out and landing on the ground around you? And you were fixing equipment that had somehow been damaged by the eruption. What did it look like?
Well, it looked, there was pumice on the ground. There was ice chunks up to 6 or 7 miles away that, pieces of the glacier in the summit that had been blown out and large mud flows that were pouring down the glacier that drains the summit area there, and it the full trees had been washed down towards Cook Inlet. It was a pretty dramatic scene.
You kept the helicopter fired up while you're there for fear that it could start rumbling up and you'd need to get out of there.
Yeah, that's right. We we have satellite phones And as part of the precautions we take when we're working around active volcanoes is we keep helicopters running and satellite phones on in case the people in the operations room, like Peter, call and say, something's happening, time to go. And we would go jump in the ship and leave.
And what about the oil storage on down the Drift River? Are they still in a state of readiness to evacuate? Are they still out of there? Do you know, Cyrus or Peter?
Yeah, I think they're... They have crews that go over there during the day and are working, but I don't believe anybody's living there at the moment. And I think, the storage and the containment has been working the way that it was designed. And so I think Chevron is pleased that their engineering has succeeded thus far.
Let's hope that stays safe and that you stay safe the next time you're on the mountainside. Cyrus Reed, thank you very much for being with us today.
All right, thank you.
Cyrus Reed there in Girdwood, Alaska. He's been as close as anybody to Mount Readout as it's been erupting since the weekend. Peter Cervelli is with us from the Alaska Volcano Observatory in Anchorage. We're joined as well now from Washington by Marion Gufanti. She's senior geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Marion Gufanti, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So how are you watching Readout? How significant an eruption there?
Well, I can watch the eruption in much the same way that Peter in the operations room watches it on computer monitors because the data is, telemetered to computers.
Right to Washington.
And mm-hmm. Available on the Internet. So in my office in Washington, I can actually look at the real-time seismic data as well.
Now,
I try to also track the impact of the eruption on aviation.
That's been a big deal all week long, flights grounded in Alaska. And describe for us what volcanoes can mean for air traffic.
Right. When a volcano-like Readout erupts, it has a lot of gas content in the subsurface magma. And as it comes out of the summit, it explodes very violently and throws all that magma as little blobs up into the atmosphere very high, and it cools into little glassy shards. Mm-hmm. And then it drifts in the jet stream and the high winds aloft, hundreds to thousands of miles from the volcano. And you can imagine that if a jet aircraft were transiting into that area, their jet engines would just suck those little glassy rock and mineral particles into the engine, and it causes a lot of havoc. It also abrades the windshield and the fuselage. So we've had, this is not a hypothetical hazard. Mm-hmm. This has really occurred where aircraft have flown into these ash clouds inadvertently. So we know the kind of damage that can occur, and as a result, aircraft always seek to avoid flying into these volcanic clouds.
I'm looking back here, 1989-90, when Redoubt was erupting, and its ash stopped the engines of a KLM jet in mid-flight. The plane passenger liner dropped 2 miles before its crew could reactivate the engines. That would definitely get everyone's attention. Peter Cervelli, we've seen whole planes wrapped in plastic to avoid this kind of ashy stuff, pumice, you know, glassy shards coming out of Redoubt this week just to keep them safe.
There have been a lot of precautions taken against volcanic ash. In some cases, it's overreaction, but in some cases, it's quite prudent. Ash is it's not a toxic substance, but it can be a very corrosive and a very abrasive substance, and it certainly makes sense to protect valuable assets from ash accumulation.
And so are planes back in the air now? Are they having to maneuver around ash clouds, Peter?
Well, aviation has been disrupted into and out of Anchorage. USGS doesn't make those calls. We're an advisory agency. We provide the best information possible to agencies like the FAA, and they're the ones who handle rerouting air traffic. And of course, the airlines themselves make decisions about when to fly. Sometimes the decision is made to fly only during the day when pilots have an opportunity to visually identify ash plumes and to avoid them while in flight.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about volcanoes popping off from Alaska to the Pacific Islands, Tonga. What makes them rumble? What makes them blow? It's our chance to talk with a volcanologist, and we're going to grab it. We've been talking with Peter Cervelli. He's a volcanologist and geophysicist at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, joining us from Anchorage, Alaska, and with Marianne Gufanti, senior geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Let's have a little more sound here. Another part of a report from Anchorage NBC affiliate KTUU on an overflight this week by researchers near the erupting Mount Redoubt.
In a flight over the area today, officials with the Alaska Volcano Observatory couldn't see Redoubt's summit, but they saw the eruption's fallout, starting high on the mountain on the Drift Glacier.
There was a huge flow of muddy water cascading down the Drift Glacier, down the middle of the Drift Glacier, that was cutting a deep channel in the glacier with some really impressive waterfalls. So this is really muddy, sediment-laden water.
From the glacier, the mud flow swept through the Drift Valley, uprooting some trees, stripping others of limbs and bark. The mud flows continue to Cook Inlet, a mile wide, surrounding an oil terminal holding 6 million gallons of crude. The terminal was evacuated.
And that from up in the land of glaciers. And then last Friday, tourists on a fishing boat in the South Pacific got as close as they dared to the underwater volcano now active 7 miles off Togan Tapu in the Tongan Archipelago, Tonga. You can see the spectacular visuals of this eruption on this tape if you look on YouTube. You can hear these tourists were getting as nervous as they were excited as the water near them erupted pillars of lava, smoke, and steam.
Ready to what? Run away?
Run away. It will come very close, this smoke. So,
It is coming very close.
Better start it up. Turn us around already.
Get us out of here. You can actually see that video at our website now, onpointradio.org, and it is really spectacular when that eruption comes right up out of the waves into the sky, something I've actually never seen on tape. Marianne Gufanti, have you been following the undersea eruption in Tonga as well? Is this unusual? Is this what happens all the time in the Pacific Ring of Fire?
Yes, there are other underwater volcanoes that have erupted like that. The only evidence sometimes we have of them, though, if they're not observed, are rafts of floating pumice. And then we try to work back as to what volcano that may have come from. But in this case, it was well photographed, and it truly is spectacular.
So here's one question. I don't know how this works. Ring of Fire, we all know about all around the Pacific, from the west coast of the U.S. down into South America, up the Alaska and the Aleutians, then down Japan and past Krakatoa territory, down into the South Pacific area. Are these things, could they be connected, Marianne, or do they all operate kind of on their own local pressure, I guess?
Each volcano is operating separately. There are very, very few exceptions to that. But they are all linked by this system of plate tectonics that we've probably all learned something about in our geology classes. Mm-hmm. So the Ring of Fire is an area where there is a lot of subduction of one plate diving under another and causing some water-rich material to melt and rise up and create the source zone for all of these volcanoes.
And in the South Pacific, you talk about the pumice that is erupting out here. It's floating there. They describe an island having been more or less created by this volcano. Does that become permanent, or does it eventually sort of fill with water and sink again, float away?
Either outcome can happen. But let me point you to an example where new islands were formed, and that would be the Hawaiian Islands. Mauna Loa.
Heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah, Mauna Loa is considered the biggest volcano in the world because it started on the sea floor about 35,000 feet depth and slowly over the eons, millions of years, built up to break the surface of the water, hold firm. It may, as it broke through the surface of the water, the Hawaiian Islands, they probably grew and were destroyed, but over time they accumulated enough lava to survive the wave action and they created the Hawaiian Islands.
Listen,
so in the short term, they may break up or create, mm-hmm. but over the long term, that's mm-hmm. how many island chains are formed.
Listeners, we want to hear your volcano stories today. We're looking at Alaska, looking at Tonga, looking beyond that. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and George. George, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. This is George. I was in the Philippines in 1991. I was stationed at Park Air Base. I mm-hmm. just arrived in May, and I was assigned to the lab. I was the lab officer there, and I was in the process. When the rumbling started, they decided, when they decided to evacuate, they assigned me the task of packing the equipment up.
Now, you're talking about rumbling starting. You must be talking about, I've been at Clark Air Force Base many times. You're talking about Mount Pinatubo nearby there in the Philippines.
Mount Pinatubo, right.
Mm-hmm.
Mount
yep.
Pinatubo. And when the most amazing thing is, I was in the lab, I think, when they had several major explosions, and because of the evacuation and the fact that I don't remember all the details and the exact days anymore. But
this was a big eruption in 91 of Pinatubo.
Big eruption. The first major eruption, I was in the lab, and it was about 30 miles, 35 miles as a crow flies from the peak. Mm-hmm. I remember the whole building, which was a five-story building, started to shake. And I've never heard a noise as loud as that. I was standing next to a guy, and he was talking to me, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. It was that loud.
You ended up impressed with the power of that particular volcano. Marianne, I hear you there.
Power.
Yes, yes. I was going to try to comment that, George, you experienced something very, very special. Pinatubo was the second largest eruption in the 20th century, the largest being Katmai in Alaska in 1912.
Mm-hmm.
That was an extremely large eruption. It sent ash to 100,000 feet. It occurred in the middle of a typhoon, which caused some of the effects of the ash to be very bad as it
blown all over,
absorbed water and became very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, the USGS and the Philippine Volcanological Agency had been monitoring Pinatubo and were able to predict that eruption, and many thousands of people were evacuated ahead of time, and the death toll was greatly minimized. But, George, you really were in a unique place.
George, you're a lucky man, not least to get out of there alive. But thank you for calling. Let's go to Anna in Litchfield, Connecticut. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I saw a map once. I have a statement and a two questions. I saw a map once that plotted volcanoes, earthquakes, and continental plates, and they looked like they very clearly had a relationship. And it sounds like, from what you said before, that certainly that would be so for volcanoes. And if you could confirm that for earthquakes, that would be great. And the second part of my question is, if volcanoes and earthquakes are both sort of based on pressure that builds up, different kinds of pressure that builds up underneath the earth and causes these things to happen, is there some way in advance to relieve that pressure?
That would be some major intervention, but let's get some major expertise right here, Anna, for your questions. We're joined now as well from Pasadena, California, by Mark Simons. He is a professor of geophysics in the Seismological Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech in Pasadena, studies volcanoes worldwide using satellite imagery to detect bulges in the Earth's crust as volcanoes become active. Mark Simons, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you're actually not a volcanologist. You come at this from a different sort of angle of expertise that may go to Anna's question. Describe how you look at this and the whole big picture, Mark.
Indeed. I'm considered more of a generic geophysicist, if you like. And one of the things we like to do is to measure how the Earth's surface deforms and moves using a variety of technologies, expressly to be able to see where stress is accumulating in different regions and where we would expect it eventually to be released, either through earthquakes in certain areas or volcanoes or volcanic eruptions in other areas.
So to Anna's question about earthquakes, is there a connection? I mean, Marianne, of course, talked about the tectonic plate map that we see around the Ring of Fire, but what about earthquakes and volcanoes? Is there a relationship?
Oh, absolutely. Many of the volcanoes that we are concerned with around the world, as was mentioned previously, occur in the Pacific Rim and generally at the boundaries of the tectonic plates, which is also where you have a lot of earthquakes, because these are where these plates are either coming together or sliding past each other, as in the San Andreas Fault in California. And volcanoes, as was described earlier, occur frequently either where the plates are diverging from each other, where at what we call the mid-ocean ridges, places like Iceland, for instance, or where the plates converge. And that's where you have subduction zones and where we have the Cascadian volcanoes and the Japanese and the Alaskan and the Aleutians. And so they are spatially correlated and they are due fundamentally to the same plate tectonic process.
Now, you study what you call deformations in the shape of the Earth itself, the planet. Do those matter somehow, or is it just...
Absolutely. We're able to now, using kind of the technologies that you have in your car, such as GPS, to measure how the ground moves with an accuracy of a millimeter over distances of thousands of kilometers. And so as, for instance, in a volcanic system, as a magma chamber gets pressurized due to an influx of new material in the magma chamber, the surface of the Earth has to react, just like a balloon expands when you increase the pressure. Mm-hmm. And so by measuring the very small local movement of the surface of the Earth, the deformation of the Earth, we can try then to go backwards and figure out what's happening in the subsurface and try to get an estimate for how much magma is moving around in the plumbing system, so to speak.
And what about the notion of human intervention here? Is this something, at last, that's really beyond our influence? Anna wants to know if there's some way to, could you go in, relieve pressure? We read recently something about the Three Gorges Dam and all the water backed up, perhaps even having been responsible for the terrible earthquake in Sichuan last year, if I've got that right. Is it possible that, humans might influence the very surface and bulk of the Earth?
It's for this kind of problem, it's actually very unlikely, nearly impossible. The amount of energy associated with large earthquakes or large volcanic eruptions is huge. And there's lots of activity in the Earth which is much larger than what we could ever induce ourselves. And furthermore, I suspect from a legal perspective, you wouldn't ever want to consider trying to potentially trigger a large natural disaster.
Peter Cervelli, I guess sitting up in Alaska watching this coming, it's pretty clear all you can do is monitor and prepare. You're not exactly – you don't have an off switch for Mount Readout.
No, we certainly don't. One of the tools in our monitoring toolbox, however, is exactly what Mark just described, the global positioning system, the GPS receivers. And they are invaluable not only for researching and understanding how magmatism and volcanism works, but also for forecasting volcanic activity. At Readout, we were not fortunate enough to have a GPS network, so we really were, in a sense, blind in one eye when it came to forecasting the short-term behavior of the volcano. And this is in contrast to Augustine volcano, which erupted a few years back in Alaska, just 100 or so kilometers south of Redoubt, where we did have a robust GPS network and were able to do our forecasting job quite a bit better. So there's a very complementary relationship between the research that Mark is doing and also the monitoring that we at the Alaska Volcano Observatory do on a day-to-day basis.
Is this the monitoring that Governor Bobby Jindal was talking about in his speech after Barack Obama's last month?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what Governor Jindal what was saying or referring to, but you know, volcano monitoring is well, if I were to generalize it, it's using the best available technology that we have to understand what the volcano is doing and to use the measurements provided by the monitoring tools to forecast potential hazard, and then also ultimately to better understand how volcanism and magmatism works in general. And with this better understanding, it also improves our ability to make forecasts in the future.
Let's get a call from Christy in Branford, Connecticut. Christy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My son is 3.5, almost 4, and he loves volcanoes. He's gotten this fascination with them now. We've taken all the books out of the library and watched on the internet the underwater explosion and whatever we can about Mount Redoubt. And he has a lot of questions that I can't answer. For example, are these two eruptions connected? And also, how do people know that the Earth's core is made of iron? I mean, they're coming from a almost four-year-old perspective, but I can't answer it.
Okay. Marianne Gufanti, how about it? We touched this before, but again, any connection between in the Ring of Fire between a Redoubt eruption and an eruption undersea near Tonga, or is that just too distant, unrelated?
Yes, unrelated, too distant, too far apart. I will say that one new research result in the last 10, 15 years has been, though, that large tectonic earthquakes can trigger a kind of a seismic response in volcanoes with big hydrothermal systems. Now, that doesn't cause them to erupt. I'm not saying that. But there is a transfer of stress from one area to another, and Mark can speak more about that, that shows that the Earth is probably more interconnected than we yet understand. But it's certainly clear that someplace like Tonga and Alaska would be unrelated.
And to our 3.5-year-old's question about what's at the center of the Earth and what's coming up in a volcanic eruption, I mean, this is not magma coming from the Earth's core. This is much nearer the surface, Marianne, right?
Correct. You know, the Earth's core is hot. As the planet formed from the planetary dust and gravity coalesced the planet, there was heat from that densification of all of the molecules, and there were radiogenic atoms concentrated at the center of the Earth and also spread elsewhere in the crust and the mantle, and so there's a lot of heat coming out of the center of the Earth, and that ultimately is what drives volcanism on planet Earth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about volcanoes popping off from Alaska to the Pacific Islands, Tonga, What makes them rumble? What makes them blow? It's our chance to talk with volcanologists, and we are going to grab it. What's your question for our volcanologists today, our Earthman, Mark Simons, in Pasadena at the Seismological Laboratory at Caltech there? Very happy to have him with us. Marianne Gufanti is with us from Washington, a senior geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and from Anchorage, Alaska, where they have been right on top of the Mount Readout eruptions, monitoring them, you know, just minute to minute there in Anchorage. Peter Cervelli is with us, geophysicist and volcanologist there, professor at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Let's get a call from Noreen in Buffalo, New York. Noreen, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
If I remember right, the whole northwest United States is supposed to be sitting on a volcanic time bomb where this magma is building up in a big well beneath the northwest, like under places like Yellowstone,
mm-hmm.
ready to explode in some mother of all explosions. And I wanted to see, I think, I don't know if I saw that in National Geographic or what, but is that true?
It's a good question. I saw the same thing when I was reading up for this show, some really kind of apocalyptic visions of what could come out of Yellowstone. Marianne, I read that it last blew out there something like 600,000 years ago, and it's on about a 600,000-year cycle. Are we due for something out of the Yellowstone area, and how big, how bad could it be?
Well, gosh, we might be due plus or minus 50,000 years, so
okay,
don't hold your breath.
Okay, we won't set the alarm by it.
Yeah, this is the supervolcano concept, and indeed Yellowstone is the largest magmatic system in North America. But the pattern of eruptions is very, very huge time between each one, and it's only based on 3 points anyway, so it's not a trend that you can extrapolate.
Based on three points, what does that mean, Mary?
Three eruptions, three of those big
caldera-forming eruptions. Oh, I see, over long history.
Right. So we do monitor Yellowstone as well. The USGS works with the Yellowstone National Park and the University of Utah to maintain a system of seismic network, a GPS again, as my colleagues have mentioned, and I think we're well on top of it, so to speak.
What scale would that be? When you look back at those three eruptions, what were they like? And you know, if it's
off the scale. We have something called a volcano explosivity index. It's a little bit like a Richter scale, not exactly mm-hmm. though. And readout might be a 3 mm-hmm. on that scale. Mm-hmm. And gosh, Yellowstone would probably be a 9. And that's a logarithmic scale, so there are orders of magnitude difference in between each level. And as with many natural systems, the natural physical systems. Smaller events are far more common than large events. So those kind of caldera-forming eruptions are really rare. And in any case, certainly right now, there's not a well of magma. That's a kind of a oversimplification of what the physical environment would look like at depth. It would be more mushy and crystals mixed up with some melt and that kind of thing.
But is this
so
the scale
of... I think it's fascinating, but not to worry about.
But would it be just... It's absolutely
bigger than Krakatoa.
Bigger than Krakatoa.
Bigger than that. Oh,
so
yeah.
This would be global ramifications, I guess, then.
Sure. But really, it's not anywhere in the offing.
Oh, no, we're not trying to send people fleeing from Colorado or from the western United States.
Okay.
Nevertheless, it's very interesting. It's part of our Earth history, and you know, at some point, Mark Simons, at some point it's out there again. I mean, it may be 50,000 years, but the Earth is not finished with dramatic events, Dr. Simons.
Oh, absolutely not. But at the same time, these dramatic events are rare and far between. What I'd like to do actually is go back to this issue of the relationship between these events around the globe,
mm-hmm.
because that's a question that keeps coming up and mm-hmm. comes up frequently. I think it's interesting because, in fact, around the globe, there's an average of about 50 eruptions a year. And so it's tempting to draw a connection between two of them. But in fact, they're going on all the time. Furthermore, underneath the oceans is where we get 3/4 of the volcanic activity on the planet mm-hmm. at the mid-ocean ridges. So volcanism is quite pervasive, and looking for connections between distant events is quite a challenge at best. However, it's interesting that if you go back, even Charles Darwin noted in 1835 on the Voyage of the Beagle that he experienced one of these large magnitude 8.5 earthquakes in Chile, when he was walking around the landscape,
yep,
and noticed that immediately following that, there were several large volcanic eruptions at the same time. And so this is one form of connection that is, in fact, quite well established now, that after large earthquakes, sort of magnitude 8 and larger, frequently volcanic activity increases significantly. And that is an important hazard in areas that have both these large fault systems, such as in Cascadia, and are also close to these large volcanic systems like Mount St. Helens or Mount Rainier.
And last week, when we had the Tonga Pacific eruption, there was also a report of a 7.9 magnitude earthquake.
That's correct.
The cause and effect, or did those appear linked to you?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, they are side by side, and it's hard not to... So I don't see a connection. Of course, that's what you study. Let's go to Chris in Windham, Vermont. Chris, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you today?
Very well. What do you know, Chris?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. And I was at Washington State when Mount St. Helens blew up. My wife and I were about 200 miles from it, and it was the loudest thing I ever heard.
At 200 miles distance. Wow.
Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, the ash was just a nightmare for absolutely everything. I knew some people that were in Spokane, which is quite a few miles from Mount St. Helens, but in midday, it was absolutely pitch black.
Yes, I remember. I remember. So did it set you thinking about volcanoes and what causes them, Chris?
Well, as a matter of fact, The interest in earth movement and volcanoes tends to be because we're human. And if there, if we weren't in the way, they would just do their own thing without us even worrying about it. I was wondering if your scientists have any thoughts about, we talk about the universe and the stars and the moon as gravitational and influences on the universe. Would they have any thoughts about... the universe having a little bit of a pull on us, causing volcanoes and earthquakes and stuff like that.
Good, interesting. Mark Simons, it sounds like you're bailiwick, extraterrestrial influence on volcanic or, for that matter, earthquake activity here?
The various forces that we get from extraterrestrial sources, sort of gravitational forces, mm-hmm, and so on, are just so small compared to the other stresses in the Earth that it is not believed to be that important, with the exception of if you were to actually get an asteroid impact, of course, then that modifies the situation. I think the other thing to point out, actually, is that most volcanoes on the Earth are not monitored because it is difficult to get to them. It's difficult to telemeter data back. And so one of the big developments now in the last few years is the technology that permits us to start to develop a globally synoptic view of all these volcanoes from satellites, using optical satellites that take optical images, radar, mm-hmm, satellites that can measure the ground deforming without ever being on the ground, or satellites that measure the temperature of the ground through thermal infrared and can tell you if there's shallow magma moving around very close to the surface. And so really the future in terms of understanding these systems is quite extraordinary. Already we're starting to get a glimpse of the fact that there's a lot of magma that moves around the shallow crust that never results in an eruption.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, complicates the story quite a lot.
Yes. Because it just doesn't find a path to the surface?
It's a great question. And to be honest, we don't know the answer. It's clear that if the pressures exceed some kind of threshold, they can find their way to the surface. They may find themselves to be in some sense neutrally buoyant, like a scuba diver, and settle in somewhere some tens of kilometers below the surface, and only eventually some subset of them will find their way to the surface. In surveys throughout the world now, in Chile and Central America and Java, we're finding that there's all sorts of signals that are apparent when we try to measure with these satellites or with GPS, the sort of deforming of the surface in small bullseyes, effectively, that tell us that magma is moving around, and yet there's no eruption forthcoming. And sometimes there's not even a large volcano on top of these areas. So clearly in many areas, there's a lot of magma moving around and no eruption imminent.
It's busy down there when it's busy. Jacqueline in Salt Lake City, Utah. Jacqueline, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
With the rapid melting of the polar ice caps, does that involve a change in pressure that would increase either frequency or intensity of earthquakes and volcanoes?
That's interesting. Peter Savelli, let us go first to you. Here you've got readout in glacier country. You hear Jacqueline's question. Everyone's thinking about global warming these days. I mean, any chance that you lighten the glacier on the flanks of that mountain and you get an eruption?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, qualitatively, you could spin a story that if you lighten the load on top of a volcano by removing a bunch of glacial ice very quickly, you could create conditions that would favor eruptions. We, in fact, don't see any evidence of that occurring, although the time scales wherein we might be able to measure such evidence are quite long. So, like many experiments and hypotheses about the effects of global warming, it's going to take quite a while to see if they are coming true. One thing that is known, however, is that the retreat of massive continental glaciers over the years or eons ago has caused something called glacial rebound, where the crust actually is coming back into its original position before it was depressed by the glacial ice, and there is seismicity associated with that process. But I will say that the study of how glaciers interact with volcanic systems and volcanic eruptions is one that is quite fruitful and is definitely expanding.
And maybe more relevant than ever as if the glaciers are shrinking. Let's get a call from Groton, Connecticut, and Aaron. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I hear you guys been talking about the sheer amount of energy released in volcanism and seismic activity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's enough to move around the plates that construct the surface of the Earth. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know what sorts of research and development has gone into actually harnessing that energy for us to use.
Great question. Marianne, what about
it?
We've got all that magma down there, energy sort of locked in it.
Maybe. Yeah, there have been experiments in the past to try to drill close into magma bodies and use the heat from magma to then produce electricity. Mm-hmm. They didn't turn out to be engineeringly sound, but it does bear on the question of using geothermal heat. And a lot of geothermal heat, the natural heat of the crust, is concentrated in volcanic areas. And you use this naturally heated water then to turn turbines and create electricity without having to either use nuclear energy or fossil fuels, you know, coal and oil. So in an indirect sense, mm-hmm. that energy can be used through geothermal. I'd like to make just a quick point about energy production, because I'm not sure people always understand that mainly what we're doing when we are creating electricity is that we're boiling water.
Right.
And to do that,
get
you know,
steam,
we can
turn the turbine.
Yeah. You turn a magnet inside an electrical coil and you generate electrical current. So you can boil that water many different ways, and using naturally hot water is one of them.
Mark Simons, this is in your turf as well. What about it? I mean, when you talk about big bodies of magma beneath the surface, where they're not necessarily even volcanic, we've got geothermal, but is there some more significant, profound way of tapping into that that people in your field are thinking about that might be an energy source for widespread usage?
I think right now, I mean, we've covered the bases in that sense. We may be able to exploit it more efficiently or more extensively. There are lots of geothermal power plants that work as was just described. You can imagine having more extensive water recirculation systems to drive turbines, but I'm not aware of any as yet credible system that would sort of tap some unknown source of heat in the Earth.
Marianne, here's another one. Everyone's wheels are turning out there on the energy issue. From our website, a listener, Ed, asks, he says, speaking of subduction zones, would it be practical to make use of these volcanic sites as dumping places for radioactive waste? Marianne?
The process, the system of subduction has a lot of energy overall, but it's a very slow process. It's not like a conveyor belt that's just going to move that stuff right down there. It would sit in the trench at this join between the two plates for a very, very long time before it would actually get subducted down. So, no, it's not viable.
It's not going to just happily swallow it up into the earth and we'd be done with it.
No, it's not like a garbage disposal.
Not that simple. Peter Cervelli, what's the outlook? You're up there in Alaska looking at readout. Peter, what's the projection here? Is it possible to say how long it may keep, you know, belching up there? How long the eruptions may go on?
The past is the key to the present, and we do have some experience with this volcano. Not a lot. It last erupted in 1989 and went on to 1990, and that eruption lasted about 6 months, and that seems to be a fairly typical time frame for eruptions of this type. We expect that it's going to go into a phase of something called dome building, where viscous lava gets extruded and builds something called a lava dome, which isn't precisely dome-shaped, but it takes on the gross shape of a dome, although it's quite rubbly. And occasionally those domes will fail. They'll go tumbling down the glacial valley of the Drift River, and that itself will cause an explosion and an associated ash plume.
Wow.
So we do expect intermittent eruptive activity.
Peter, we're out of time right there, but we love the language, rubbly dome building. Peter Cervelli, Marianne Gufanti, and Mark Simons, thank you to all of you, volcanologists and beyond. It's been great having you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.